The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with Speaker Vice President Al Gore.
My name is Monroe Carman. I'm president of the Press Club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. Our afternoon newsmaker today is Vice President Al Gore. He will discuss the first 100 days of the 104th Congress, in particular, the Republican tax cuts and other provisions of the GOP contract with America. The Vice President will speak for approximately 30 minutes, and then we'll answer a few questions. There should be microphones at either side for those who wish to ask the Vice President questions. He's on a very tight schedule, so I ask you to please, when he finishes, remain in your seats until he departs. Mr. Vice President.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bud. I appreciate your introduction and the invitation to be here, and I also want to thank your executive assistant, Melissa Bender, and the officials of the club. As Bud mentioned, I want to talk about the first 100 days. After David Stockman left government and felt he could talk truthfully about his experience in government, he wrote in his book about the day early in 1981, during the 100 days of that administration, when he and Dick Darman met together in a state of near panic to see if they could make changes to the budget. They had been looking at the numbers, and they had come to the conclusion that the numbers didn't add up. In fact, they had decided that the budget was, in Stockman's word, insanity. Should they try to fix things? Stockman wondered. And Darman gave the classic answer, we win now, we fix it later. Well, much of the last decade has been spent trying to fix that decision. But many, if not all those efforts, failed until recently when we began to turn things around. And it's generally recognized now, of course, by members of both political parties that from the standpoint of fiscal policy at least, the 1980s were a disaster, an absolute disaster. In fact, if it were not for the interest that we will have to pay this year just on the debts that were incurred from January of 1981 until January of 1983, the budget this year would not only be in balance, but would be in surplus. Democrats and Republicans now both acknowledge that. And because both parties acknowledge the need to avoid that kind of decision making, we hoped 3 months ago that even though the Republicans captured both the House and the Senate, things would be different. Specifically, we hoped that the two parties could work together, at least on the important things like fiscal policy that require bipartisanship. And actually, in the first few weeks, we did accomplish some things together, like the very first piece of legislation passed by the 104th Congress. That was the law which applied to Congress all the laws which apply to the private sector. You may remember that the House, though not the Senate, passed it in the 103rd Congress. But in any event, the President was very proud to sign that bill with bipartisan support this year. And so the 100 days began on a note of optimism. More recently, we saw eye to eye on the line item veto. And even though the versions passed by the House and Senate are very different, The President looks forward to the day when he can sign that into law also. And we hope to work together on other issues, like welfare reform, as the year proceeds. But the first 100 days of this Congress will not be remembered for bipartisanship or for accomplishments for the American people. They will be remembered for the damage done by the Republican contract. This week marks the end of their work on this highly partisan, extremist 100-day agenda. Like the discredited trickle-down economics that nearly bankrupted our nation in the 1980s, this 100-day juggernaut is also a mistake. But this time, we don't have to wait 12 years to stop the damage. This time, we can start correcting the mistakes on day 101. In order to do so, we must use these last few days of the first 100 to assess the damage that has been done and to clearly spell out who wins and who loses under the Republican contract. That's what I want to discuss today. I want to talk about winners like the tax expatriates, whose cause is the absolute disgrace of the congressional Republicans, and I'll come back to that in a minute or two. And I want to talk about those who would lose, like the hardworking middle-income American families who are being asked to pay for another round of Republican tax cuts for the wealthy. But before we look at what they want to give the wealthy, let's look first at what they're taking away from middle-income families. First, their plan would make it much harder for middle-income families to send their children to college. Specifically, they have passed cuts in student loans that would affect 4.5 million students, raising the cost of college to them and their families by as much as $3,150. And they're trying to cut the direct lending program, an unqualified success, incidentally, which is saving taxpayers billions of dollars while making it easier for students to repay their loans. And they're trying to cut it simply because some of their banker constituents are angry about losing the revenue that they used to get from serving as middlemen on student loans. In fact, while most Americans agree strongly with President Clinton that education is more important than ever in our effort to raise incomes and improve standards of living, the Republican Congress has spent most of their first 100 days establishing a reputation as the most anti-education Congress in the history of this country. Do we need a plan to raise school standards, they wondered? No, was their answer. They cut it, cut 4,000 schools out of money needed to raise standards and improve teaching. Do we need a plan for safe and drug-free schools? No, the Republicans said. They cut it. They cut funds for metal detectors and security people in schools. Do we need job training? No, not really, their plan concludes. They cut that too, by over 3 million job training opportunities. Do we need a plan easing the path from high school to work? No, thank you, the House Republicans said. They cut it, delaying reform in 22 states. And of course, as you know, the House Republicans cut the federal school lunch program. Since their hand was called on this one, they've been trying to convince unhappy constituents in both political parties that it wasn't really a cut. But their effort isn't working because it's not true. The effect of their cuts is to take a lot of children who would otherwise be eligible for school lunches and make them ineligible in the future. In fact, if this cut had been put into effect in 1989, it would have meant that over 1 million children in 1994 would not have received school lunches. The same is true with the terrifically important Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Nutrition Program. They cut it right away, giving new meaning to the phrase women and children first. They would even gut by up to 72% the National Service Program, which has been winning applause all over this country. 20,000 dedicated young people tutoring, building homes, cleaning up our rivers, working with the disabled. That means that this year and next, 30,000 young people would be sent home or stopped from serving. I've had an opportunity to meet with a lot of these young people. Maybe some of you have too. I have seldom seen such enthusiasm, such patriotism, such a dedication to this country. You'd think this would be one program the Republicans would leave alone, but the Rules Committee chairman said it's get even time. That's a quote. And so they cut it. Well, most Americans feel that what we need in this country is not to get even, but rather to get things done. In assessing the damage done during these 100 days, after looking at education, we need look no further than the Republican assault on safe drinking water and clean air. Middle-income American families want their children to be able to drink tap water without getting sick. But Republicans in Congress have allowed lobbyists for polluters to walk right into the halls of Congress and write changes in the law to allow a lot more pollution in the water and in the air, because their clients don't want to pay the money to keep the pollution out of the water and the air. These lobbyists meet regularly right in the majority whip's office. The Republican leadership relies directly on the lobbyists for the polluters to write the laws and then explain the details of what they're doing to the Republican staff members and members of Congress. It really is a disgrace. When we see them work side by side with lobbyists to roll back the protections of the Clean Water Act, we draw the line. When we see them through the so-called takings bill, trying to establish a multi-billion-dollar entitlement program for the worst polluters and wealthiest corporations in the country, we draw the line. When it comes to destroying the environment, we draw the line. And you know, perhaps the worst part of the 100-day agenda has been the cynical effort to cut programs that are needed by middle-income families and then use the money not to cut the deficit or to benefit middle-income families in other ways, but to instead give a huge tax cut to the very wealthy. The clearest example of what I mean is the provision that I call the poster child of Republican tax policy, the poor expatriate billionaire. Being a citizen of this country is one of the greatest privileges any human being on earth could have. But there are, of course, some who renounce their citizenship in order to make a little more money in taxes. Not average people, extremely rich people. Imagine this. A bunch of billionaires, and I won't mention their names, but they've been listed in some of the papers represented here, who walk into an embassy and say, I no longer choose to be a citizen of the United States. I no longer feel loyalty to the United States. Yes, I made my fortune in America, and I still want to make investments in the United States, but I have no sense of duty, loyalty, or patriotism, so I'll become a citizen of some other country to get a bigger tax break. That is a disgrace. They don't deserve a tax break. But the battle lines have been drawn in the Congress, with the Republicans trying to give a huge tax cut, almost $1.5 billion, to this tiny group of billionaires that turn their backs on America, walk out on America, renounce their citizenship in the name of pure greed, and the Republicans are fighting for them and cutting school lunches, student loans, protection for clean water and clean air, and using the money for that group of expatriate billionaires, in part. This provision is part and parcel of a Republican approach to tax policy that can also be seen in the design of the long-awaited Republican tax plan that reaches the floor of the House this week, a plan that they call their crown jewel. And I guess that is an apt name for it. But does it promote economic growth? No. Is it fair? No. Is it gimmick-free? Of course not. But it is a royal ripoff. So the title they gave it, Crown Jewel, is quite appropriate. It's Robin Hood in reverse. Take from the kids, take from education, take from protecting our water, take from all the programs that actually help hardworking middle-income American families, and give it to the wealthiest in the country. So let's look at who wins from this Republican tax plan. It gives more than half of the tax cuts and three-quarters of the capital gains benefits to the wealthiest 12% of Americans, those earning more than $100,000 per year. And it gives 20% of the benefits, fully one-fifth of the benefits, to the wealthiest 1% of Americans, those earning more than $350,000 per year. 20% of the tax cuts under the Republican plan, let me repeat, go to the wealthiest 1% of the people. Let me put it this way. If you earn from $10,000 to $20,000 a year, their plan would give you an average of $90. If you earn over $350,000, you get $20,000 per year. $90 for middle-income families, in that example, $20,000 to the wealthiest 1%. That's a jewel, all right, for those who can already afford them. And it doesn't make sense, nor does it help those who need help the most. And this jewel is bought with the credit cards of average American families. So no one should be fooled. Even with all the cuts to the programs which Americans hold most dear, the Republican plan still costs America an extra $630 billion. In essence, they're cutting school lunches to give the wealthy a free lunch. And so this week, when America talks about the winners and losers from the Republicans' 100-day agenda, just remember the simple description. The well-to-do win and everybody else loses. Oh, if you're the Republican leadership, you win. They've increased the funding for their offices 50%. They've kept federally funded frequent flyer miles for their own use. They've preserved gifts from lobbyists. But American citizens lose. Citizens who depend on a school lunch, people with disabilities, first-time home buyers, young people who need college loans, and their parents, people who need work training, public health, public safety, our environment. It reminds me of the old Abbott and Costello plan where Costello says, Bud, if you had $50 in one pocket and $75 in the other pocket, what would you have? And Abbott says, somebody else's pants. How do Republicans get the money to pay for their winners? By taking $630 billion from the pockets of the losers. It's ironic. For those who support these giveaways to the rich, those who support pitting one group of hardworking Americans against the other, those who support adding $630 billion to the deficit, are the very same people who over the years have given the most ringing and occasionally persuasive speeches about the deficit. They're turning their backs on that commitment too. So to those who have reversed their course, I say this, go home and tell your voters that you're willing to put $630 billion of new debt on their backs, and tell it to their children and to the students and the people who have to work hard to pay for $20,000 a year tax cuts to the very wealthy. Explain to them what your exploding deficit really means. And I say to those members of Congress at the end of this 100-day period, your contract is not with the Republican Party. Your real contract has to be with the people of America. And that means you're going to have to make some changes. I believe the American people are ready to draw the line, and so is President Clinton, especially when it comes to three wrong-headed attempts to block or roll back progress. And let me mention them specifically: the minimum corporate income tax, special interest lobbyist provisions, and the expatriate tax evasion matter that I mentioned a moment ago. We remember the days when huge international corporations paid no taxes at all, not one dime. We believe that every big corporation that's making money should pay some taxes. That's only fair. And that's why we favor the minimum corporate income tax. And when we see the Republican plan abolish that tax to return us to the old days when giant corporations earning hundreds of millions of dollars get away without paying a dime in taxes, there's another place where we draw the line. We believe also that Congress should be free from the grip of special interests. So when Republicans assemble lobbyists in the Majority Whip's office to stop new standards for safe food, for safe workplaces, and safe water and air, we draw the line. And that expatriate billionaire provision is simply unfair to the rest of the country, and we draw the line there. If you want a perfect issue that illustrates clearly what the first 100 days represent, look at who Democrats and Republicans are fighting for today. While Democrats are fighting for $1.3 billion in funding for kids and education, Republicans are fighting to allow these 24 billionaires to escape $1.4 billion in taxes by renouncing their citizenship and turning their backs on the United States of America. Those Republicans fighting for these 24 billionaires really ought to be ashamed of themselves. What Republicans promised could have brought Americans together. What they did during these first 100 days are driving Americans apart. They promised Social Security would be off the table, but then they defeated amendments designed to protect Social Security. They promised not to slash Medicare. Now they call Medicare a candidate for steep cutbacks. They said they would require tough sentences for gun crimes. They then pulled tough sentencing laws out of the Republican crime bill. They said they would cut red tape. Now they're cutting loopholes for polluters, cutting new loopholes into the law. Enough is enough. It's time to stop letting the lobbyists run the show. It's time to stop cutting special breaks for the rich into the law and cutting out Special K for kids. It's time to return to Main Street economics and mainstream values. Middle-income American families need help paying for education and buying first homes and caring for their kids and paying for health care and health insurance. That is why President Clinton's agenda is very different. His new covenant builds on the tax cut of 1993. It is aimed directly at those Americans who have not shared in the economic recovery and who have been hammered by the rising costs of education and health care. The president knows how hard it is for middle-income families to raise young children. That is why his plan contains a child tax credit. This president knows how hard it is for middle-income families to prepare their children for the jobs of the 21st century. He knows that in this time of global competition, nothing is more important than making certain that we have the most educated and best-trained workforce in the world. That's why his plan has an education tax deduction for college, community college, graduate school, vocational school, and worker retraining. The president knows how hard it is for middle-income families to save for retirement or medical emergencies or to buy the first home. That's why his plan expands IRAs and allows penalty-free withdrawals for education, medical expenses, or that first mortgage. We would like to work with Republicans in creating a plan that both sides like, a plan that helps our schools, feeds our children, and trains those who need job training, and protects the environment. Ladies and gentlemen, when we look back over the last half century, my party has a proud history of representing the middle-income families that are the backbone of this nation. No doubt we've grown and changed over the years, but at its core, the Democratic Party has consistently stood for the values that have made this country great. And these values, this core, we will not abandon. Look at all that America has done for the hardworking middle-income families that made our country great. In 1954, almost 4 out of 10 Americans dropped out of school before getting a high school diploma. That's different now because of legislative initiatives ranging from Head Start to the Higher Education Act. We're proud that Democrats did that. Think about what it was like to be an older American in 1954. The average Social Security benefit was $59, so to be old was to be poor. Social Security and Medicare turned things around for older Americans. Democrats did that. And of course, it would be ridiculous for me or anyone else to stand up here and claim that Democrats have a corner on all the wisdom in this country. We know very well that we do not. There is a proud tradition in the Republican Party also. It is a tradition of limiting government, ending unnecessary bureaucracy, and of tolerance. It is a tradition followed by Howard Hogan, a 1994 graduate of Georgetown University, presently working in AmeriCorps. He's fought fires in Idaho, he's cleaned up streams in Maryland. He was voted outstanding teenage Republican in his high school class. When Howard heard about the cut in AmeriCorps, he said this, "I understand that we have tremendous deficits and the taxpayers are heavily burdened, but if we give up what is best about America, what kind of legacy do we leave?" Well, President Clinton and I believe that we can leave a legacy of hope and opportunity. For if memory serves me, there is also in America a tradition of bipartisan cooperation, a tradition of Democrats and Republicans working together when that is what the country needs. I remember when the bald eagle was on the verge of extinction and the time when when the Cuyahoga River caught fire in Ohio. We turned that around, thanks to Democrats and Republicans. I remember when there were those who thought the Soviet Union's empire was poised to conquer, whether in Europe or Latin America or Asia. And yet over 50 years, Democrats and Republicans worked together. And now the Cold War is over, and the Berlin Wall is down, and we have the promise of freedom and democracy spreading all over the world, thanks to a bipartisan commitment to work together on those things most important to America. We cannot now let our future fall to the hands of those who believe in the politics of debt and despair. We cannot let the years ahead belong to those who say, "Win now, fix things later." On day 101, we're going to start fixing the damage that was done during the 100 days of the Republican contract. Let us follow the tradition of those like Howard Hogan who believe we can leave that legacy of hope and opportunity. And in the words of Dwight David Eisenhower, to define democracy in one word, we must use the word cooperation. Now that the fever is subsiding, let us cooperate. Now that the irresponsibility of the 100-day contract is clearly visible to Americans in both political parties. Let us instead work together, Republicans and Democrats. Let us make sure that we have learned from yesterday's mistakes as we shape the lives of tomorrow. That way, all Americans can be winners. Thank you.
Your questions now. The microphones I see are at the two aisles.
Mr. Vice President, you obviously don't like what's happened with the contract, but what are your alternatives now? The new covenant and the middle class Bill of Rights are essentially dead on Capitol Hill. Where do you go?
What was the second phrase? The new covenant or what?
And the middle class Bill of Rights seem to be dead on the Hill. What are your alternatives?
Well, I don't think, I don't share your assessment. I think that the debate on tax law is likely to move definitively in the president's direction. Already you're seeing discomfort on the part of Republicans now that the spotlight has been put on the provisions in their tax bill, like the expatriate billionaires ripoff. And you're seeing discussion among Republicans of amendments that would cut way back on the line below which Americans would receive a tax cut. Our view is that middle-income families ought to get tax cuts, not expatriate billionaires, not the wealthiest 1%, not those who don't need it, and that we should cut the deficit and focus the tax relief simultaneously only on those who really need the relief, and that's middle-income families. And I think you're going to see the debate come around in that direction. Yes?
Mr. Vice President, you used the phrase line in the sand. I think it was drawing a line several times, but you didn't use the word veto. Wondering if you could tell us specifically what it is in the contract that's already passed through the House that if it stayed in its current form, the president's administration would veto.
Well, the phrase draw the line is the most appropriate one to use when talking about principles that we will fight for. The word veto, of course, applies only to specific pieces of legislation that make it through both houses of Congress and can then be analyzed in their own right. There are some provisions that you can clearly anticipate in advance. A takings bill with automatic compensation, for example, is one where I would certainly strongly recommend a veto. But the phrase draw the line is just what it says. It is a line that they're on one side of and we're on the other side of. They want this tax break for 24 billionaires that renounce their citizenship. We don't. We want a tax cut for middle-income working families.
Mr. Vice President, specifically, a proposal by more than 100 Republicans to lower the cap on the child care credit from $200,000 to $95,000. Is that an acceptable compromise? And secondly, you didn't mention drawing any lines about capital gains tax cut. Are you willing to negotiate on that?
Well, it's theoretically possible to design a provision of that kind that would benefit middle-income families, but I haven't seen one even remotely close in the Republican Congress. The first provision that you mentioned, lowering that line down is one thing that I had in mind when I said you're beginning to see them moving in the president's direction. And I predict that you'll see that movement speed up, and I think the odds are growing that there will be a tax cut that is much, much closer to what President Clinton recommended and proposed to the country in his middle-class Bill of Rights. They tell me I've got time for only one more, and I apologize to those who are standing at the mic. Yes?
Yes, one of the biggest pieces of non-contract legislation being considered is the telecommunications reform bill, and it's received very little attention so far. How concerned are you that the Senate bill could lead to higher cable TV and potentially telephone rates?
Very concerned, because that would be the obvious outcome. What they have done is to send a bill out to the floor that would virtually do away with regulation of cable television rates, even where there is a monopoly. See, the FCC under the current law has already been moving rather forcefully to allow increases where there is improved service and new programming. And under the law, whenever there is competition, then the regulation is eliminated. What the Republican bill would do is eliminate regulation for monopolies. And they try to disguise it in language that say that the increases will be limited by the increase in the national average, but only two companies basically control the national average because they have almost half the market. And so it actually introduces, you could argue, perverse incentives for faster rate increases because they not only get the extra money from captive customers who have no competition to turn to, but at the same time they also raise the national average and expand their ability to gain future increases. Secondly, they set up a situation where the telephone company in a town can buy out the cable telephone, the cable television company, and have only one provider of both services in the community, and then they take the Justice Department out of it. So it's no wonder that those two industries are applauding what they did, but the American people lose as a result of it. So I'm hopeful that they will make a lot of changes on the floor and in the House and in the conference committee, and I hope that that there'll be a lot of changes in that, because it would clearly be very bad for the American people.
Mr. Vice President, a quick one.
All right, thank you very much. I'll take just one more. Yeah, go ahead.
Last one, though.
What is your? You've known the Speaker a long time. What is your assessment of his performance during these first 100 days?
I find it hard to answer that question because I count him as a personal friend. We came to the House of Representatives only 2 years apart from one another. We worked together on a number of issues. He and his wife are friends to my wife and me. I disagree very strongly with a lot of the proposals that he has made, and I see him wrestling with the new responsibilities that he acquired with his new position, and so I try to separate the personal relationship from the strong disagreements that I have with the proposals, with many of the proposals that he has made, and my reaction to the proposals is probably best summarized in the speech that I just gave. I think the 100-day juggernaut has done a lot of damage, but the good news is that unlike trickle-down economics, we're not going to have to wait 12 years to undo the damage. we can start on day 101 correcting the extremist mistakes that the Republican House members tried to put over in their juggernaut. And I think you've already seen that process begin. But let me close by reiterating a point that I also made in the speech, and that is that we want to work with the Republicans to solve problems in this country and to move forward. We've proposed a lot of changes, such as President Clinton's Middle Class Bill of Rights, his new covenant, and we hope very much that the Republicans, after the conclusion of this 100-day period, will be looking more to the national interest and more to a bipartisan approach and less to this juggernaut that is now coming to a conclusion. Thank you all very much.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.